For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, let's dig in. Now for the matters you wrote about. It is okay for a man not to marry, but to avoid immorality, each man should have his own wife, each woman her own husband. Okay, let's see. So it's okay for a man not to marry. They must have written him. They must have been thinking about, it's like some of us are thinking about going celibate. We're not getting married. And we're going to find out later in the chapter that that's what it is. Yeah, they were considering avoiding marriage because in an environment of persecution, having a family is a liability. This sounds a little contradictory. He's saying here it's good to be single, and here it's good to be married. So, which is it? Well, that depends on the person. And this matter about which they wrote, the question of celibacy. I don't think it's celibacy as you see in a lot of religious thinking where people are ascetic and think that sex is dirty and that you're more holy if you're single. I think it was more situational. He goes on and says, check this out. The husband should fulfill his wife's sexual needs, and the wife should fulfill her husband's sexual needs. The wife gives authority over her body to her husband. Yeah, everyone knows that. And the husband gives authority over his body to the wife. That's not what the ancient people believed. They believed the man had the right to do whatever he wanted. And the wife was like a possession to him. What? She has authority over my body? Boy, it's probably not easy for the modern reader to realize how radical this is in terms of equality between man and woman. So shocking, so at odds with ancient thinking. Think about a passage like Galatians 3:28. There's no longer Jew nor Gentile, slave or free. Male or female, you're all one in Christ. Oh man, that's just so radical, so cut across what every culture, Jewish, Greek, and Roman, held at this time. And, it's awesome. Today we read this and we're like, yeah, you know, what's the big deal? But Paul is, in favor of sex. He says, do not deprive each other unless it's by mutual consent for a time, so you might devote yourself to prayer, then come together again so that Satan won't tempt you because of your lack of self-control. He says, I say this as a concession, not as a command. So that's interesting. So some of the things Paul says are authoritative. He says, I adjure you in the name of the Lord to do this or that. And so he had that as an apostle. He had that authority to tell people, you need to be doing this. He says, this isn't that way. It's a concession. So basically what he's doing is he's giving them wise counsel. He's giving them an opinion that he thinks is they should consider, but not coming down with some rule he's imposing. He says, I wish everyone were single, just like I am. But God gives to some the gift of marriage and to others the gift of singleness. Paul was a single man. There's pretty good evidence, I would say, that he was married at one time. When he speaks about marriage, he sounds like a married man. He knows, you can tell he knows what it is. Also, he was on the Sanhedrin, and you wouldn't be on the Sanhedrin unless you were 30 years old and married. So people were married way before 30, but everyone was married by the time they were 20. People got married in their teens back then. And so Paul, either his wife has died or she's divorced him. It could have been divorce, because if someone became a Christian, a Jewish family had the right to boot that guy out and take their daughter back home. And so that could have happened to Paul. Or maybe he's a widower. Anyway, both marriage and singleness, he says, are gifts from God, properly understood. Each has its own advantage. He seems like he's favoring celibacy here, like I wish most people would go this way. And I think the reason that he's favoring celibacy over marriage here is explained later in the chapter, down in verse 26. He says, I think then that it is good in view of the present distress, that it's good for a man to remain as he is, single. You know, getting caught, thrown in prison, getting cast into the Colosseum with wild animals. Savage way to die. What if you saw your children and wife thrown in there? It'd be even worse. And so it's not unusual for when people are under intense persecution to be like, maybe this isn't the right time to start a family. Later, maybe. And I think this is the thinking here. Well, he says, to the unmarried and to the widows, I say, it's okay for them to stay unmarried, as I am. But if they can't control themselves, they should marry, for it's better to marry than to burn with passion. This passage always bothered me, because I'm thinking, you know, so that's it? That's the reason to get married, is so you don't burn with passion? Sorry, there are no other reasons than that? Sounds like it isn't a real high view of marriage in a way, that it's all about sex. Well, when you think about it, you know, if it's companionship, if it's affection, if it's partnership, you can do all those things with someone you're not married to. Really, the difference with marriage is it does add that sexual component. And so that is God's provision. I would say it's not pulling marriage down, but what it's doing is pulling sex up to a higher level and realizing that's a celebration of that union relationship. And so in other words, being celibate is a good thing if you want to go that way, but not if it's going to cause you to fall into sin. And if you know, some people just know, I don't have the gift of celibacy. I know I sure never did. And and when that's the case, you need to, you know, find a good life partner, get married. But to the married, I give instructions, not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not leave her husband. But if she does, she should remain unmarried, or else be reconciled to her husband. And a husband should not divorce his wife. Okay, first of all, this expression, not I, but the Lord, is basically saying that he's directly quoting Jesus at this point. Probably from like Matthew 19, where Jesus said, you know, you cannot get divorced, and if you do, you should go not marry someone else. And so he's saying, I'm getting this right out of the text of the Gospels. Whereas in other places he says, this isn't from the Lord, but I have an opinion, and I too am spiritual later in the chapter. So it's not that what he's saying doesn't count. It's whether he's directly quoting Jesus or not. So the ideal is right here. Don't get divorced. Don't leave your spouse. And this, he says, is true even if they're not believers. To the rest I say this, I, not the Lord. He says, this is coming from me. But it's not like before where he says, I say this by concession, like this is just advice. He's saying, no, I'm telling you what's right here. If any brother has a wife who's not a believer and she's willing to live with him, he should not divorce her. So you hear your people coming to faith, they're already married. One of them believes, the other one doesn't. It's called being unequally yoked. It's a drag, you know. I have found something that is so important, it's like the centerpiece of my life, and my wife can't get into it. Ow. That's definitely going to lead to friction. And yet you can work that out. People do work it out. You have this happening all the time in our own church. People come to Christ and they're already married to someone that never buys into it. Well, the Christian is being called to a sacrificial position there. It doesn't mean that they're going to stop walking as a believer. It means they're going to continue to walk, but the spouse is willing to accept that, then do not consider that a reason to leave. And if the woman has a husband who's not a believer and he's willing to live with her, same thing. He says, for the unbelieving husband has been set apart through his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been set apart by her believing husband. Otherwise, your children would be like other kids, profane, normal, but as it is, they're set apart. In each case, this term, to set someone apart, some translations translate it to make holy, because that's what holiness means, is set apart. Basically, when you have a believer in a family, God says, that entire family is marked. I'm going to speak to them. I'm going to be coming strong, showing them that I'm real, and they're going to have a better chance of coming to faith than other people would. And so if you're in a family that doesn't believe, you should claim this promise here that they are set apart for special dealings from the Holy Spirit, and that you have an excellent, don't give up on them, keep praying for them. And there's an excellent chance that one by one, we see it all the time, members of the family come around, sometimes years later. Well, has been set apart, yeah. If the unbeliever leaves, on the other hand, let him do so. A believing man or woman is not bound in such circumstances. God has called us to live in peace. So here's a non-Christian. They're saying, I will not agree. We're not staying together unless you get out of this Christian thing. At that point, she or he is like, I'm sorry. This is what I am. And so he may walk away. And Paul's saying, in that case, let him go. And it's a biblical ground. It's desertion. It's a biblical ground for divorce. And he says a believing man or woman is not bound in such circumstances, which most readers take to mean that they're not bound to be in the marriage, and they're not bound to not remarry either. They can freely remarry. If you have a biblical grounds for divorce, then you're set free from that oath. That's what I think it means, yeah. Well, how do you know, he says, oh wife, whether you will save your husband? Or how do you know, husband, whether you're going to save your wife? You don't. The way he's phrasing that requires the answer, I don't know that. So being set apart is not a guarantee that they're going to come to faith. There's no such guarantee, because we are free will beings. God is not going to overrule their free will. But he will give them a real hard pitch. Okay, so a few things that we can see already in connection with divorce. First, divorce is bad. It's not God's will. When God first created humans, he says, this is how marriage works. You leave your mother and father, you cleave to your wife, and the two become one. And it stays that way until death, like the oath says, until death do us part. That's the only thing that ever separates a marriage under an ideal scenario. Divorce is so rampant in our culture. And it was very common back then, too. They actually had a pretty high divorce rate, probably nowhere near as bad as us. Where half of all marriages fail in America. It's about half of all marriages. What a frightening thought. That ought to really put some seriousness into your walk. You know, most of us would not play Russian roulette. You know, it's too dangerous. There's one chance in six that you're going to fire the bullet through your head. In this case, there's three bullets. Half the chambers are loaded for you to have the most awful experience of your life, a self-ego-shattering, horrifying experience. Wow. Scary. We need to sink deep roots into our spiritual growth and our relational capability. This is not something to walk into lightly. People think, well, we just love each other so much, I don't think it'll be a problem. Oh, boy. That's eros love. That's gonna fade away. Okay? You're going to suddenly, you're there with this person. She might as well be your sister most of the time. There isn't that heart pounding, oh, she comes again, huh? And she's like, you've changed. None of his friends notice any change. She just was never seeing him objectively. She was seeing him through this lens of romantic love. And now she's faced with the real guy. And so a lot of people want to get out of it at that point. Running away. from their problem. It's wrong because it's breaking a promise. You promised that you would stay, and you need to keep that promise. I always stress that with people that I'm counseling for marriage. Is you can never get out of this. You can never back out. You can never even consider that. And you're promising that today. And if you can't say that, I don't want to be a part of this wedding. You need that commitment in order to make a marriage succeed. You need to know that neither one of us is going to run away. That is the necessary ground that you stand on. It's not a shifting ground. It's a solid ground that whatever problems we run into, we're going to face them and we're going to solve them with the power of God and the people of God. It breaks a picture. I mean, Scripture teaches that the union of man and wife is like a picture of our union with God, and which is eternal. And so here we shatter that picture. It's very harmful to children. Oh, man, I don't know if you've read the literature on this. I just updated some research I had on it. This study of 174 children showed that the incidence of substance abuse in offspring was associated with parental divorce. Children of divorce had 7 times the risk for developing substance abuse disorder over in the children of intact families. Columbia University, New York Psych Institute. These are not, none of these are Christian or religious sources. These are all secular scholars. This study is a survey of the research on this subject by Jane Anderson, University of California, prepared for the College of Pediatricians, American, it's children doctors, 2014. And so she's surveying all the things that the different studies have shown. Every point she makes in this, she gives a scholarly study that backs it up, and she's quoting from it. I didn't give you all of those citations, but you can get this report online free. Just Google that, Impact of Family Structure and the Health of Children. Children of divorce have earlier sexual debut, which in turn is linked to all kinds of negative consequences to begin having sex earlier in life. 14, 13, 12. Girls whose father left the home before they were 5 years old were 8 times more likely to become pregnant as adolescent girls from intact families. Oh my, 8 times. Not 10% more likely, not 50% more likely, 800% more likely. Boy, is that bad. And of course, teenage pregnancy is a huge problem. If you're a teenager here with a child, you know what I'm talking about. How is that girl going to progress in life? How is she going to get out of poverty if she has a baby to take care of? She can't. This is super harmful. As adults, the female children of divorced parents experience less trust and satisfaction in romantic relationships. It would be hard to trust. Where's dad? Why did our dad leave us? And is that going to happen to me? Yeah. It would make it hard to trust. And these are longitudinal studies. A lot of these studies run 25 years. They follow the same kids for 25 years of their life. And here they are in adulthood, still having the negative impact of divorce. Children of divorced parents are less likely to view marriage as permanent and less likely to view it as a lifelong commitment. They're getting ready to do the same thing their parents did. They're twice as likely to have been absent from school for 11 or more days in the past year due to illness or injury. Well, why are we getting into that? It's because it's measurable. They're trying to pick out things that can be measured. And so if you are having large-scale absenteeism, it's poor nurture, it's neglect, or it's mom's boyfriend that's abusive and causing injury often. Children of married parents attained higher income levels as adults, way higher, in the $15,000 a year range, higher on average than children of divorce. It's measurable. Single-parent kids are more likely to have a learning disability or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, regardless of their parents' education. They can control these studies for parents' educational level. Children living with married parents are half as likely to be abused or neglected. Or we could say children of divorce are twice as likely. I've seen some studies have it higher than that. A study of almost 1 million children in Sweden, that's a huge sample, demonstrated that children growing up in single parents were more than twice as likely to experience a serious psychiatric disorder, commit or attempt suicide, or develop alcohol addiction. So, and the Swedes are not exactly conservative. Okay, Sweden is divorce central also, and cohabiting. Only a minority of Swedes ever even get married. But their own study shows single parent families, not good enough. Children of single parents are twice as likely to have emotional and behavioral problems, according to another study. Center for Disease Control reported on adverse family experiences among children in non-parental care. The study found children living with one biological parent were between 3 and 8 times as likely as the other children to have experienced neighborhood violence, caregiver incarceration, or to have lived with a caregiver with mental illness or an alcohol or drug problem. So the parents are the ones that mess up, and the children pay the price. Many of you here are children of divorce. You know what this is about. You've experienced this. Even adults, I thought this was interesting. Married men are less likely to commit suicide than men who are divorced or separated. Married individuals have the lowest incidence of diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease. It's just a healthier way of life, I guess. Married men had a 46% lower rate of dying from cardiovascular disease than unmarried men. And they controlled this for age range, too. So it wasn't just like college students or the singles. Married men earn 22% more than single men. It's a pretty sizable margin. Women who experience divorce face a 27% decrease in their standard of living. No one pays more for this than the women. It's the hardest on the women. They usually wind up as the custodial parents, and they're single parent. And the child payments often aren't there, or they're inadequate, very inadequate. Harmful to children, very harmful. No wonder God says in Malachi 2, "I hate divorce," says the Lord. Divorce, bad. But also, we need to remind ourselves, it can be healed. If you're a child of divorce, the best thing that I have seen for healing some of the scars and deficits that children of divorce have is to get into a community of the people of God and to live in community. And there's really a God changes lives and can heal damage that's come into us. There will be a price to be paid. And it's not going to be easy either. There's never anything easy in this area. But we totally see God transform, and we have many examples today of solid, happy marriages involving one or both being children of divorce, which is not that common in the world. Usually children of divorce repeat the problem that their parents had. Finally, though, divorce may be the lesser evil. Even with all of that's wrong with it, some case situations are so bad that it really warrants divorce. I think he's given us one in this passage. If the unbeliever leaves, let him go. It's basically saying, you know, that to try to compel that person to be in that marriage against their will, there's going to be so many negative ramifications from that and acting out. And there's many other cases. I mean, you have cases where there's a violent spouse in that home that's harmful to the children, that's dangerous. A lot of people think that anything heavy enough to warrant being kicked out of fellowship is heavy enough to warrant divorce, in theory. Jesus definitely said that adultery without any question. If a spouse goes out and commits adultery, that other spouse has the option of declaring that marriage over because it has been ended, the bond has been ended by the adulterer. Now, they can also forgive and try to rebuild that marriage, but it's up to them. And, yeah, not bound. And so there's total freedom in that case. Well, he goes on to the married, I give this command, not I, but the Lord, that the wife must not separate from her husband, but if she does, she remain un... And so she shouldn't separate from her husband, but if she does. So he's realistic enough here to realize it's going to happen. You know, Paul is not talking theory here. He's talking real living in the city of Corinth. And he knows it's going to happen. But then he says, then she should be reconciled to her husband and remain unmarried. And I think, though, he qualifies this later and actually makes it so that even in this case, you could remarry. Because down in verse 26, we already read where he says, I think it's good in the view of the present distress, that it's good for man to remain as he is. Then he says, are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be released. Are you released from a wife? Do not seek a wife. This word for bound and release is the word for marriage and divorce in Greek, to loose your wife, is to divorce her. So he's saying, if you're married, don't seek divorce. If you're divorced, don't seek married. But check this out. If you do marry, you have not sinned. So in other words, what this is a case of, there's a couple of things involved. It's hierarchical ethics. If being unmarried is leading you into sin, and because you lose it and you're under too much temptation, it's not worth it. It's an ideal, but there are more important things. And so in that case, it would be better just to go ahead and get married. It's not ideal. And so, finally, two, divorce usually solves nothing because people who get divorced and remarry are twice as likely to divorce the second time and three times as likely to divorce on their third marriage. You talk to divorced people a lot of times, all they do is rag on their ex, you know. What an idiot he is, what a... Yeah, she was... And all they can think is to demonize their ex, and they never face the fact that what was my contribution to this, and that's why it never helps. U.S. Department of Health Education. This is the Census Bureau. One of the most clear-cut findings is the high likelihood of divorce for people who have been married more than once. The average duration of marriage before divorce is only half as long for the second marriage, and a third as long for the third marriage. And this is how they measure frequency of divorce, is the length of time between marriage and divorce. So, don't get divorced. There's a deeper fundamental problem that Paul speaks to here, which is that they are believing that if they change their circumstances, then that'll fix them up. You know, it's like, I'd be fine if I just get out of this marriage, then I'll be okay. Boy, is that ever unlikely. I just need to move to California. That's what I need. You know, we got ants in our pants. We can't hold still. And we always keep thinking, well, I'll do this. I'll change this. I'll change jobs. I'll do this and that. Different roommates. And that is really unbiblical thinking. This is what Paul says about it. Each one should remain in the place in life that God assigned to him and to which God has called him. This is the rule I lay down in all the churches. That the Lord assigned him. That language assumes, in the first place, that God is sovereign and that he knows your situation, he knows your makeup, and he has you in the situation you're in. He knows you personally and exactly, and he has a plan for you that you need to discover, and the first place to look is right where you already are. Grow where you're planted, in other words. Don't think, oh, God's plan for me is in Florida. Yeah, the Bahamas. Yeah. He also says, to which God has called you. So this calling of God, he's saying the role where you are. And this is not talking about people use this term, I feel called by God. It's like it's some feeling that God's, Dennis, go to Switzerland. That's not what he's talking about in context here. He's saying, for instance, in the next verse, if you're a slave, so they didn't feel called, oh, I want to become a slave. But you are a slave. And he says, that's your calling. You are called to Christ in that situation, and so make the best of it. was a man Caldwell, already circumcised, Jewish. He should not become uncircumcised. Okay? You can't become uncircumcised. That's not... He is speaking metaphorically, not if you're born Jewish, don't try to become un-Jewish, to become Gentile. Continue to live as a Jew. Something that was absolutely, this passage was abandoned by the early church, and they started to call on Jews to deny their own Jewishness if they wanted to follow Christ. A huge mistake. And if you're called uncircumcised, then don't become circumcised. You're a Gentile, stay Gentile. Live like a Gentile. He says, that's not important. Circumcision is nothing. Uncircumcision is also nothing. Keeping God's commands is what counts. Each one should remain in the situation in which he was in when God called him. Were you a slave when you were called? Don't let it trouble you. You know, it's the breaks. You're a slave. You can learn to follow God in that role. They had a lot of slaves in the early church. We've talked about that before. Although he says, if you can gain your freedom, do so. Do you stay a slave or do you change? A little confusing here. He says, he who was a slave when he was called by the Lord is the Lord's freedman. Similarly, he who was called a freeman when he was called is Christ's slave. And so he says, you were bought with a price. Do not become the slaves of men. Okay, so what we have here, this is not legalistic thinking. He's basically saying it kind of depends on the situation. You know, yes, if a slave has a chance, which they often did, they could buy their own freedom if they saved money or have a friend buy their freedom for them. And so sometimes also owners would just free a slave because they were their friend. They liked them. So they made him a freedman, they call him. But legalistic thinkers are saying, look, just tell us what we have to do. And that's not what Paul's doing here. Instead, he's giving them ethical principles, understanding the willingness to submit ourselves to servitude of God. But you also see that the first assumption is, start with where you're at. If you're always desiring to change your circumstances, you can't stay put in one place. You can't stay into long-term relationships. Your friends are revolving. It suggests that you're refusing to see that most of our problems come from within. And we're thinking that our circumstances change, then everything will be okay. And like I pointed out to one girl years back when I was talking to her, she was going to run away to California. I was like, you know, you go to California, everything is going to be different out there except for one thing, you. And you can't run away from that. And sure enough, she wound up coming back a few years later, all busted up. It hadn't helped at all. A lot of times our motives for changing our circumstances have nothing to do with God. People in America run around to make more money. They move from city to city to increase the bottom line, get promotions, avoiding problems. It's like I've just so blown this scene. I'm so alienated from all my friends. I'm just going to jump off to a new city, go to a different university. Yes, I'm married, but this girl's so hot. You know, I got to have her. And I know God wouldn't want me to be unhappy. So I'm going to, you know, change my circumstance, get out of this marriage. Yeah, real carnal thinking, really unwise. This fails the wisdom test. Yeah, notice too, when he says, do not become the slaves of men, it shows that Paul was anti-slavery. He thinks that this is not something that should be happening, but he wasn't going to lead a slave revolt and get the Christian movement squashed by Rome. It just would be too foolish to do that. So they worked with slavery in a slave-owning culture. They just had to. There's no option. But you can see that he's against it. Brothers, he says, each man is responsible to God, should remain in the situation God called him to. And so the default, he's not saying you can never change. Because he gave the example of slavery, you can change. He also gave the example of a marriage. Maybe you do get divorced. But the default, the assumption is that I'm going to stay the same. If I think I want to change, the burden of evidence is on why should you change. As far as staying where you're at, you don't need any evidence for that. That's the default. That's what we normally do. And so when we apply all that we've seen here, first thing I see, don't become a runner. Some people are runners. They flee from their problems, run away. There's never any end to it, never solves any problems. And it's a very defeating and depressing way of life. If we have problems, the best thing to do is to face them, maybe get some help. And, you know, if you're in conflict with people, we can resolve that. We talked about that earlier. We have the tools we need to be able to resolve conflict. And, you know, if you're depressed, we work with that not through running away, but by getting involved in solid Christian counseling and taking the steps needed in your life to get your affective life turned around. Stuff like that. Running away. Also, learning to make and keep commitments. The thing that the divorcee can't do. The thing that a lot of us are afraid of marriage because we're just afraid to make a commitment. Again, we have ants in our pants. We have to keep changing all the time. It's not good. It's not mature. I have people that think that God's blessed my life and that I've been successful, and I feel that way too. I feel very, very blessed by God, and He's caused my work to flourish, and my family is good and healthy. So that's a great blessing from God. But sometimes people ask me, well, what has there been from your part, from your side, that's contributed to this? And you know, it's kind of hard to say. I don't know. But there is one thing that comes to mind that I attribute a lot of my personal success to, is that I've always stayed put. I, you know, started ministering in this group in 1970. It's almost 50 years ago. I've never seen any reason to do anything else. And so what happens is, by staying into a fairly narrow band of values, there's improvement all along the way. And the same thing, you know, with my marriage and family, to stay in there. And even when our marriage was at its hardest times, we talked and we were like, one thing's for sure, we're staying here. And we're going to find out what victory means in this situation. So I commend that to you. Just, you know, really think about it. Yes, your job is so crappy that it's interfering with normal living and healthy living, then change. There are situations where, you know, your living situation is so destructive, you need to get out of that situation and get into a more healthy environment. So I don't think he's saying we shouldn't seek out a healthy environment, but the burden of evidence is more on whether we change than whether we stay the same. And there is, I think he is recognizing kind of a neurotic running mentality that a lot of people develop. It's unhealthy. And there you have 1 Corinthians 7. Yes, we do see, God, from these studies that when we violate your pattern and decide to do things a different way, people are wounded. That has caused serious damage. And so getting in line with your prescriptions for life is really important for our own happiness and the happiness of our family that we hope to have someday. And most people still hope to have a family. And that is not a forlorn hope. You can show us how to do that if we trust your ways in it. I also am thankful that you join yourself to us in a mystical way that is analogous to marriage, and that marriage is a picture of. It's really cool that we are a part of you and that you'll never leave us. And we thank you for that, Jesus. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.